Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Willow Belden. Right before the close of the session, the Wyoming legislature slipped a small amendment into the budget bill that's proving to have some big implications. The footnote prohibits the State Board of Education from considering a set of national science education standards that it had been reviewing for more than a year. And as Wyoming Public Radio's Stephanie Joyce reports, it raises questions about whose role it is to establish those standards.
The budget amendment that passed the House of Representatives was broader than the one eventually signed into law. But Goshen County Representative Matt Teeters says the intent was the same.
My original amendment was an attempt to stop the next generation science standards by just stopping any sort of science adoption for the next 2 years.
The next generation science standards were developed by a consortium of 20-odd states and have been adopted in 10. Standards guide what students should know and be able to do in each grade level, but they're different from curriculum, which is set by local school boards. Teeter says the next generation standards are flawed in multiple ways.
The standards themselves, I believe, are structurally poor standards. And that's a separate issue, I think, from the fact that the science standards contain a lot of controversial science that I think is way too specific for what our standards should contain.
Among other things, the standards teach evolution and that climate change is caused by humans. Teeters says those are by no means settled subjects and that the standards, if they include them at all, should give equal weight to alternative perspectives.
If you look at the implication of man-made global warming and carry it out to its finality, and you begin the process of trying to limit carbon emissions dramatically in this country, I think you're going to cripple this economy.
Teeters says in his opinion the amendment addresses those concerns without tying the hands of the Board of Education.
I think they can draw from the standards. I think they just have to be very careful about rubber stamping them.
I kind of take offense to that.
That's Board of Education member Pete Gosar. He says the board never rubber stamps standards, including these ones. Gosar says the board has been going back and forth with its science committee about how the standards could be improved, and he's worried about the message the amendment sends to the people on that committee.
Well, you know, we wasted a year and a half and spent a lot of time when we thought we did the right thing, and that could be undone in an afternoon in Cheyenne. And so I wonder who will sit on these committees anymore. If we only get the people that want to just push out last year's standards, does that help move education forward?
Not only that, Gosar says it sets a bad precedent for legislative intervention in standard setting.
Science or social studies or English isn't up for a popularity contest. And once it becomes that, then I think you make your educational system not as good as it could be. And I'm concerned.
Board Chair Ron Michalai is also concerned about what the legislature's intervention means for the process of setting standards. He says he wasn't even aware the amendment was added to the budget bill until it was signed into law.
I don't mean to be critical of them. I mean, they've heard from their constituents, and they know what's in those science standards, and they're trying to voice those concerns. I'm a 16-year veteran of the legislature. So often happens at the last night, the last moment with a footnote to a budget bill perhaps wasn't as thought out as well as it ought to have been.
But some politicians who endorsed the amendment insist it's not a sign that the legislature lacks faith in the Board of Education or its process. In a press conference about the budget bill, Governor Matt Mead downplayed its significance.
I think that the legislature has, as I do, faith that the Board of Education will be able to set whatever standards, hopefully high standards, and I think that they felt more concerned that they would be stuck with standards that is not acceptable to the board or acceptable to a citizen of Wyoming.
What standards would be acceptable to Wyoming, a reporter asked? Mead deferred to the Board of Education. The board is consulting with its attorney to figure out exactly what it's allowed to consider. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
Patrick Goggles has been serving in the Wyoming House of Representatives since 2005, but at the end of the recent budget session, he announced that he will not be seeking re-election in 2014. Goggles is a Democrat from House District 33, which includes a piece of the Wind River Indian Reservation in Fremont County. He is the legislature's sole Native American lawmaker, and his district is over 65% Indian. Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhurov spoke with Representative Goggles. She started out by asking him about what he saw as his accomplishments at the Capitol.
10 years that I've been a representative for House District 33, those areas that most affect the Wind River Indian Reservation, namely health and education, I've been able to work with the legislature, vote for a new construction of schools, the CAPCON, work with the health programs to ensure that and human services programs to ensure that contracts with the tribes were in place. There were some agreements in terms of excise tax on gasoline and taxes on tobacco that were maintained, and also the budget amounts for the tribal liaisons. I was able to vote on those budget items. So overall, it was a constant piece of work for me to help the tribes maintain these areas in which they have a relationship with the state of Wyoming. The other was to maintain a positive relationship with the state of Wyoming and their Native American neighbors, which I believe I was effective in doing.
You brought up health. You said that that was one of your main areas to focus on. Your Medicaid pilot program didn't make it through this session. I'm wondering, you know, now that you said you want to make way for the next generation of lawmakers,
sure,
are there other specific things that you want whoever comes into your place to accomplish for your district?
Understanding what types of legislation affect the Wind River Indian Reservation, and how to sponsor or co-sponsor various pieces of legislation that will have a positive effect on the Wind River Indian Reservation and tribal members.
Mm-hmm. You're currently the only Native American legislator in Wyoming.
That's correct.
And so your district is largely Native American in an otherwise...
About 65%.
Right, in an otherwise majority white state. Did you feel like you carried extra responsibility in that position?
Yes, I did carry my Native heritage with me. Obviously, you know, I have long hair. And I'm probably one of the few legislators that... probably the only legislator that's Native American had long hair. And, but, you know, I adhere to the protocols of the House of Representatives, conducting myself as such. But I do believe that any Native person would experience what I experienced was a lot of educating of your fellow and legislators about the Wind River Indian Reservation and the Native people and the tribes that reside here.
Are you worried at all that the voices of the Wind River community might lose some power when you leave?
Actually, no, because I think a younger person would bring some new ideas, new energy, new enthusiasm. That has to happen. From my point of view, my perspective, Wyoming is a citizens' legislature. It was never intended to be a professional legislature where a person made a career out of it. Although there have been members that are very long-serving, my interpretation is it was never meant to be that.
You mentioned before that you were in the process of encouraging young folks to, quote, endeavor into the area of politics.
Sure.
You said your motto was, if you don't articulate the politics of your community, someone will for you.
Absolutely.
So are you seeing more young people stepping up to fill those political roles in the state?
I am seeing more young people that are interested in public office, like school board, or like serving on a local committee, such as a conservation district. I am seeing that. And I do know my own path to the Wyoming legislature was that serving in public service, community service, volunteerism, getting used to that in terms of what a public trust is, and fulfilling that service as a public servant. There's a lot to be said for that, but it is a long path. And I am seeing more young people take interest in that arena of public service.
Are you seeing young people in your area come to you for mentorship or anything like that?
I speak to several young people about politics, tribal politics, state politics, national politics. And I know there's an interest there because I talk to it. I talk to the younger persons. And it's like any other thing. You have to get to know it or study it, you know, like I did. I'm a political science major from University of Wyoming. And it probably has to be, with me, it's in my blood. Politics is it's always been an interest of mine. You know, either you love it or you hate it. And in my case, I loved it.
So do you have any sort of message for any young people that actually might be interested in perhaps running for your seat?
I would, my message would be today was that you won't know unless you try. And I know it takes courage to commit to an elected position or a appointed position, but you have to start someplace, and you won't know unless you try.
Representative Goggles, thanks so much for taking some time to talk.
Absolutely.
So far, two Republicans have announced their intent to run for Goggles' seat. One is Daniel Cardenas, and the other is Jim Allen.
When we come back, we'll talk about a value-added approach to Wyoming's minerals and discuss preparing for the risk of floods. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Willow Belden. Governor Matt Mead and a handful of Wyoming legislators are excited about an idea that they hope will create more jobs in the state and finally do something locally with the minerals and other sources of energy that the state harvests. Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck reports.
Value added is defined as a product whose value has been increased by manufacturing, marketing, or processing. To put it simply, maybe you make something locally from Trona instead of just shipping it out as a raw commodity as Wyoming currently does. For many years, politicians have talked about creating jobs and diversifying the economy in this way. But getting companies to Wyoming who can do that has always been tricky. Last year, Governor Matt Mead took a trip and saw a facility in Canada that made him think Wyoming might finally be able to develop value-added products.
An industrial-type park that would add value to our minerals, to our ag, oil, gas, Trona. And we certainly have places in the state of Wyoming that provide a great opportunity to add value, create jobs.
Laramie Representative Kermit Brown is the House Majority Floor Leader. He says another product that could benefit from such a facility is rare earth minerals.
And rare earth is used in the production of everybody in here. It's got something that has rare earth in it, mostly in the electronics industry. So perhaps there might be a way that we start with an anchor tenant that's a rare earth extraction facility or the first raw processor, and then we work it through and work it through and work it through.
He says Wyoming needs to find a way to go beyond extracting minerals.
That someday when this place is mined out, we don't want just a mined out smoking hole in the ground left and Wyoming's gone. So how do we replace that wealth?
The legislature has funded a study of what they call an energy mega campus. After visiting the Canadian facility called the Industrial Heartland Complex, they came back excited that a similar endeavor could work in Wyoming. In that facility, companies have flocked to the site to use the natural resources there to develop new products. Other on-site companies can then use those products to develop even more products, leading to a manufacturing center. Brown says that's better than just shipping raw materials.
Products that we extract from the land don't immediately leave. They don't leave on the first rail car going west or going east, but rather we have value-added processes. So when you come back to the mega campus, that's what you have. It generates jobs, it generates economic activity, and I've always been a believer that activity breeds activity.
In other words, companies in the mega campus will attract other companies. At the Heartland facility, 40 companies currently exist, and workers make an average of $150,000 a year. But before you start applying, Wyoming has a lot of work to do. Governor Mead's policy advisor, Sean Reese, says they need to identify and solve transportation challenges. They need to study and resolve land use issues, potential regulatory hurdles, and infrastructure needs.
Create an environment where businesses are going to want to come to Wyoming. Proximity to minerals, the low tax base, all of the conditions are here, so I think it could be a magnet.
Reese says the state might be best served to consider a regional approach to developing a campus. Companies could use Wyoming's oil and gas in one part of the state and hard rock minerals somewhere else. But the question is, could you really get businesses to come to places like Sundance or Rock Springs to do this? Those in the energy industry aren't so sure. The biggest reason is that nobody really understands the state's plan because nobody has consulted with them. Sean Reese.
Well, those are the conversations that we need to have.
Everyone in industry WPR contacted for this story said that they didn't know enough about the idea to comfortably comment on tape, but most were skeptical. One noted that if a glass plant wanted to come to Rock Springs, it would have already come. Still, Reese says he believes that if it's done right, companies will come.
You need to make a proposition that shows that it makes financial sense and makes business sense for them to be here. And again, if you can pull together all of those pieces to give them a full picture of the infrastructure, the taxes, the workforce, long-term commitment, I think that could be influential in a location decision.
Reese says it will take some study and perhaps some time, but ultimately, it's what Wyoming needs. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
Ice jams in the Bighorn River have caused flooding, which in turn caused damage to several homes and businesses in northern Wyoming. High snowpack could bring more floods this spring. Troy Staples is the business preparedness manager for the Red Cross in Wyoming and Colorado. He teaches business owners how to be prepared in case natural disasters or other catastrophes strike their businesses. Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhorov spoke with him. She asked why it's so hard to reopen after a disaster.
40% of businesses will not reopen after a disaster. And actually, that number increases to 80% if they don't reopen after 30 days. And most of that, in my opinion, is that a lot of businesses out there don't have plans and procedures in place to know what to do when a disaster strikes to keep their goods and services flowing into the community. So they don't have any backup plans in place to do that.
In Wyoming, we have, pretty constant snow, high winds, but we have relatively few kind of unpredictable events, few big tornadoes and earthquakes, for example. Is it harder to motivate business owners to prepare for something that seems kind of a long shot to some degree?
Yeah, that's the mindset of a lot of the businesses, not just in Wyoming, but around the country, that nothing is going to happen to me or my business. And so they feel that they don't really need to make those plans and procedures in place. But with the argument I try to make with them is it might not just be a wide area catastrophe, but there could be many different reasons why you might not be able to access your building for hours or days or weeks. For instance, you could have a roof collapse due to heavy rains or just deterioration of the building. You could have a power outage that lasts several weeks just due to the infrastructure failing. And you could have a gas leak or a furnace that goes out that can't be replaced for several days or weeks. And depending on your business, that could be a catastrophe for you. So when we look at being prepared, you don't only just want to prepare for the Mother Nature or man-made disasters, but for that individual disaster that could happen to your single business.
You advocate for a disaster plan for each business, is that right?
Yeah, that's what we try to do is we have a free program and experts that can come around to businesses around the two states, either physically or over the phone, and help businesses develop those plans because a lot of those business owners don't have any subject matter expertise on how to develop those plans. So we can help them walk them through the steps. And one of the first things we help them with is through a website that we have. It's called readyrating.org. That's readyrating.org. And that's a great website, and it pretty much walks the business owner through plans and procedures on how to create plans.
Mm-hmm. So in general, the plans focus on human resources, physical resources, and then business continuity. I'm wondering, could you go through what business owners can do to secure each of those?
Well, the basic steps is a set of continuity plans, which is a very in-depth, detailed plan. For a lot of the smaller businesses out there, one of the big things that we promote doing is one of the first steps is creating an MOU, which is a memorandum of understanding with another business that's either close to you for one aspect and another one that's either in the next town or a few miles away where there's a wide area catastrophe. So for a memorandum of understanding, an example I use a lot is if, say, you're an accounting company or a small business that does accounting for businesses and you have a gas leak in your office or the furnace fails to work and you can't access it for a week and you still have to do people's taxes for them in this tax season, if you can't do that, your business might fail. So if you have a memorandum of understanding with another office building in the next town or down the street that you can access their facility and work out of their facility until your facility is back up and running. It keeps your goods and services and tax dollars flowing in that community still. And it doesn't cost any of those two business owners any money to do that. Then vice versa, you have that for yourself, but if that other business has a failure at some point, they can come and double up at your business for one day or 3 weeks until their business is up and running. So that's a quick way for continuity plan is just to keep those services flowing. And then another thing we talked about is having an emergency response plan. There's actually a tool on the website for that too. So having an emergency response plan is finding out what your historical hazards are in your area from floods or urban fires or blizzards, power outages, whatever your historical items are, and create a plan around that. Are we going to shelter in place or are we going to evacuate? Things like that. So you have this emergency response plan in place, and you practice it with your employees or your management team. So that way when the day does happen, everyone has muscle memory and they know what to do in that situation. And then the other aspect that we look at, too, is called a crisis communications plan. So depending on what kind of business you have, if you have your own freestanding building and you have general maintenance contracts, people working on your HVAC, to clients showing up or teaching classes, and employees showing up at your office every day, and if there is a disaster coming that you can predict or you already have a gas leak in your building and you don't want them to show up, you need to have that a crisis communication plan in place about life safety because you don't want people showing up to your office and having no one be there. So a crisis communications plan, a memorandum of understanding, and develop an emergency response plan are the three areas we work with businesses to start off with on their planning.
So in Wyoming right now, we're talking about flooding as kind of the most immediate concern. Most insurance policies do not cover flood. Is there anything businesses can do if they can't purchase additional flood insurance?
Well, I would talk to several different insurance companies. I'm not an insurance expert by any means, but there might be some plans out there. Since the floodings that happened in Colorado, there is more insurance available. I think the federal government is looking at business insurance right now for flooding. And so that's something to look at through FEMA. But another thing, too, is also you might not be able to protect your building against the flood, but you want to be able to protect your IT and backing up of all your materials in there so you don't want them getting wet and destroyed. So if you have any critical information that you have, we recommend having a cloud drive and a possibility of having a backup laptop or another computer that you can store at an alternate site, preferably that same place you have your memorandum of understanding with. So in case there is a flood and you can't get back to your office, you already have stuff stored on a cloud drive and you have a backup laptop or another computer to be able to access your information so you can keep your goods and services flowing until you can deal with that insurance company or getting your business back up on its feet in those kind of areas.
Troy Staples, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
You can find Troy Staples' contact information and links to the Red Cross preparedness site on our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org.
When we come back, we'll look at the use of telemedicine for mental health care in Wyoming, and we'll visit a sheep farm that's trying to keep things local. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Bob Beck. In many parts of Wyoming, it is impossible to get mental health care. That means residents with mental conditions either don't get treated or they have to drive long distances to get services. But that's starting to change. Recently, more and more patients have been using telemedicine to get psychiatric care. Wyoming Public Radio's Willow Belden reports.
Because Wyoming is so rural, it's hard to get health practitioners to move here, and mental health professionals are no exception. PJ Tridy is with HealthLink Now, a company that provides telepsych services. Telepsych is like other forms of telemedicine. It lets patients connect with doctors who live elsewhere using video conferencing. Tridy says Wyoming needs telepsych because it's next to impossible to convince skilled psychiatrists to live here.
The lifestyle and the way of life is difficult for providers. The turnover rate for psychiatry in the state and other providers is very, very high.
Even in towns where services are available, Tridy says people don't always feel they can take advantage of them because of the stigma associated with seeking help.
The last thing somebody wants to do is have their car seen out in front of a mental health care center. It's the, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps mentality and try to deal with issues on your own.
One of the physicians trying out the telepsych system is Jed Shea. He's a pain specialist in Rock Springs, and many of his patients battle depression and anxiety in addition to their physical ailments. He says it's important to treat the mental problems along with the pain, so he set up a telepsych system at his practice.
So the patients come in here.
Here is a small, sparsely furnished room. There's no mood lighting, no soft couch, no plants or Zen paintings on the walls, just a beige armchair and a computer. After logging into the system, patients end up in a virtual waiting room. The psychiatrist's face appears on the screen. She's located thousands of miles away, in Brazil currently, but she works with many patients in Wyoming and Montana. Shea says it's crucial to have access to mental health professionals like her.
When I moved out here, there was one psychiatrist, and then he left.
There are some counselors in Rock Springs, but Shea says it's usually a long wait to get an appointment, and they can't prescribe medications to treat mental disorders.
The closest facility here for psychiatry service would be in Salt Lake City. And if you're depressed, are you going to get behind the wheel and drive 3 hours?
Telepsych is one way to get around those problems, which is why it's been growing across the state. In the past 10 years, dozens of facilities have gotten set up for telemedicine, and the state health department estimates that nearly 2,000 telepsych visits take place each month. The system seems to be working well. Valerie Miller, the psychiatrist in Brazil, is one of the practitioners who's doing telepsych sessions for patients in Wyoming. She says she's pleased, even though it's a little different than meeting people face-to-face.
There's less information that I get from folks via video, and I find that it takes me longer, sometimes more meetings with patients, to learn as much about them.
But studies have shown that telepsych can be just as effective as face-to-face meetings.
It's psychiatry, and it's the work that I've always done with patients, you know, in terms of trying to figure out what's going on and then figuring out how to best treat it.
But the system isn't perfect. Again, Dr. Shea.
I would have liked to have a lot more of my patients receiving this service, but they are not because they can't afford it or their insurance company doesn't cover it.
Shea says about 70% of his patients have health insurance that will only cover in-person mental health care, not telepsych. At $150 a session, paying out of pocket often isn't an option. And Tammy Noel, with the National Alliance on Mental Illness, says telepsych doesn't fix every problem. She says access alone won't mean everyone gets care.
I think we need to be focusing on breaking the stigma of mental health and understanding that it is not a choice to have a mental health condition.
Noel says telepsych is a good first step, but she says Wyoming has to get rid of its cowboy up mentality, at least when it comes to getting help for mental illness. And that could be a much longer process than simply setting up telepsych systems. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Willow Belden.
This week, a new statewide public education campaign was launched called Wyoming Unites for Marriage. The idea is to get support for same-sex couples. Earlier this year, a lawsuit was filed to try and make same-sex marriage legal in Wyoming. Jaron Artery of the group Wyoming Equality joins us, and he says the lawsuit seems like the quickest way to get equality.
One of the things that we talked about after the last legislative session, not this year's budget session, but in 2013, we had a domestic partnership bill, marriage equality bill, and non-discrimination bill. And after that session, even though our bills made really great progress, we thought, what is the quickest way to bring about marriage equality? Do we continue to pursue through the legislature? And I have no doubt we could probably get there eventually. But one of the things we ask ourselves is, shall we litigate? And litigation became, to us anyways, the clearest option at that point.
So what would this do?
There's two couples that have been married in another jurisdiction and just want Wyoming to recognize their relationship. And then there's two couples that are not married, but they want to get married in Wyoming. So what it would basically do is, for those same-sex couples that have been married legally in another jurisdiction, Wyoming would recognize that marriage and that relationship. And for the couples that want to get married here in Wyoming, they would have the freedom to do so.
Jaron Artery visiting with us. I want to talk a little bit about your strategy here. Not only are you doing things legally, but you're also trying to build up coalitions in the state of I think as you're calling them, diverse people. How is that going?
It's going fantastic. It's not only same-sex couples saying, look, I want the freedom to marry, but I think it's also important that we show that there are leaders in the faith community that are involved, and this is important to them. There's, you know, our straight allies. It's important to everyone. So we want to show that this just isn't same-sex couples, but there is broad and diverse support for this across Wyoming.
So what is the strategy? Will you have people speaking communities, ads? What is the plan?
Yes, all of the above. We're planning other towns and communities, everything from town halls to student events, faith coalition, and we'll be featuring same-sex couples, community leaders, elected officials, clergy, allies, basically our friends and neighbors. We'll be focusing on messaging around all those folks that I just mentioned, hoping to show that Wyoming really is ready for this.
What do you feel are the myths or at least stereotypes you need to knock down?
Oh, good question. You know, like the last few years when we were pursuing this legislatively, and we're definitely not done. There's some other things that we'd like to pursue legislatively, but I hear a lot of things that we're not normal, that we're asking for special rights, and we're trying to redefine the institution of marriage. I hear that same-sex couples are going to wreck the institution of marriage. A lot of religious arguments, you know, the Bible says this is not right. And so it's kind of the same arguments that we hear year after year.
Trying to put a face on it for people so they're maybe not as concerned?
I think that's important. I think if we can put a face to this and show that we are here, you know, my fiance Mike, he just moved up here in October from Denver, and we've been dating for over 2 years and recently got engaged. And some of our friends down in Denver, they're like, what are you doing going to Wyoming? There's not any support up there. And what we found, what Mike has found, is, you know, the move has been great. And, you know, we surround ourselves with really great supportive people. You know, we're hardworking professionals here in Cheyenne. We don't want to leave. Wyoming is our home. I was born and raised in Wheatland. I've been here in Cheyenne for about 6 years. Wyoming is home, and we want to stay here and build our careers. And it's silly that a same-sex couple would think that they would have to go somewhere else to be entitled to freedoms that other couples have with a $15 marriage certificate.
One last question before you go, and I should have asked this earlier, but I think there's a lot of misunderstanding out there about what the benefits of marriage would be beyond, you know, a love partnership. Why is this so critical, do you think?
It's a great question. You know, one of the things, like Mike and I, we cannot file a joint federal tax return. But there's over 1,100 rights and benefits that our heterosexual friends are entitled to that same-sex couples are not entitled to. And, you know, one of the very basic ones, too, is hospital visitation, being able to hold your loved one's hand if, God forbid, the unthinkable were to happen, passing property to one another, leaving pension plans, assets, that sort of thing. Those are probably some of the biggest, some of the most key talking points that we like to share and make everybody aware of, that there is some true discrimination in the system as it currently stands.
Jared, if people want to know more about what's going on and want to check out the Facebook page, where do they go?
WyomingUnites.org is the website. And if they go on Facebook, they could also search Wyoming Unites, and the same thing on Twitter.
Jared Artery, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us on Open Spaces.
Thanks for having me, Bob. It's always great to talk to you.
Wyoming has a long tradition of sheep ranching. The first flocks arrived with Mormon pioneers in the late 1880s. By the early 1900s, there were 6 million sheep, and Wyoming led the nation in wool production. Now, there are fewer than 400,000 sheep in the state, and competition in the global market is stiff. But Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards visited one family that believes that, against all odds, the life of the flockmaster is worth keeping alive.
The wind is roaring 50 miles an hour across the high plains, and the wind chill is sub-zero. It's lambing season at the Tronstad Ranch northwest of Laramie. The Tronstad's children chase the lambs around the barn, trying to catch them. Already, 11 lambs have been born. Brian Tronstad, who grew up on a ranch, says it's a way of life they believe in strongly.
I guess our whole thing here was we wanted to find a little piece of land and be able to raise a few animals and give our children a chance to experience some of the things we did growing up.
Part of that dream is to clothe their family with homegrown wool. Tronstad's wife, Lesha, is the fiber artist of the family.
She makes a lot of our clothing, and then with extra wool that we have, we do sell a little bit. So,
are you guys wearing any of your mom's wool right now?
Yeah.
Anything? What are you wearing?
I have a sweater that she made.
The Tronstads raised two breeds of sheep, Border Lesters, a traditional Wyoming sheep, and Rambouillets, a first cousin to the Merino with the same silky fibers. The Tronstads shear the sheep, wash the lanolin and hay out of the wool, dye it, and even hand spin it into yarn. The spinning wheel in the living room looks like an antique from a bygone era. Lesha Tronstad spins from a cloud of wool in a basket.
What I'm doing is stretching out the amount of fibers that I want, so that determines how thick the yarn is going to be.
In the 7 years since they bought their land, the Tronstads have primarily just fed and clothed their family with their flock, but they hope to one day make a go of the ranching business. Currently, the family relies on Lesha Tronstad's income from her job at the University of Wyoming, but Brian farms full-time.
I do. I do a bunch of different things. Uh-huh. Farming is just one of them.
They'll keep going because they believe in a self-sufficient lifestyle. But other wool producers may not. There are very few of the large-scale sheep ranches left in the state. A majority of wool growers have flocks of less than 100 head. The modern-day flockmaster needs to get multiple forms of income from their land. And one reason is because the annual losses of sheep are incredibly high.
Wyoming ranchers lost about 36,000 sheep to both predators, weather, and disease. That's roughly 10% of our industry. No industry can sustain a 10% loss every year.
That's Amy Hendrickson. She's the executive director of the Wyoming Wool Growers Association. She also says it's an expensive commodity to produce because it's hard to get enough grazing leases for large flocks. And the competition with synthetic fibers is high. There are also fewer protections for this industry than many others. And wool producers in places like Australia and New Zealand outcompete wool growers in the U.S., taking up over 80% of the industry. But Hendrickson says there are some economic benefits, since the animals do provide dual opportunities to make money.
Those animals provide a double crop, so to speak. It's rewarding to know that you can provide a protein that feeds people, but also a fiber that clothes people.
Another bright spot for the Tronstad's dream of living off the wool business is the increasing public interest in local goods. Lori Kirk is the owner of Cowgirl Yarn in Laramie, which sells the Tronstad's hand-spun yarns. She prices the yarn significantly higher than other brands.
When it is something that is basically homegrown from your own backyard, and sometimes there's even a little bit of vegetable matter, so they can even leave with a little bit of Wyoming in their yarn, it's very special. And people that truly appreciate the fiber for what it is are willing, and I'm grateful that they're willing to spend the extra money.
Wyoming continues to be one of the larger wool-producing states in the country, along with Texas, New Mexico, and Colorado. But in today's market, wool is increasingly a small cottage industry. But for the Tronstad family, that suits them perfectly. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
When we come back, we'll talk with a former member of the Forest Service who says some major changes need to be made in the way forests are managed. This is Open Spaces. Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Willow Belden. We're joined now by former U.S. Forest Service employee Brian Stout. He was supervisor of the Bridger-Teton National Forest from 1984 to 1994 and held various other positions in the Forest Service for the 24 years preceding that. Stout recently published a book called Trees of Life, Our Forests in Peril. He says he wrote the book because he feels that the current way of managing forests is misguided.
I see the forests and I believe they exist in a much more detailed manner than what science has given them credit for. In other words, when I look at a mountainside, I don't see just a forest. I see a whole mosaic of individual communities. And I believe that is critical if we are going to properly manage our forests in the future. I also am concerned that major reductions have occurred in the amount of acres being treated over the last 20 to 25 years on the national forests as a result of influence from various interest groups outside the Forest Service. And the results are that today we're experiencing more and more catastrophic events such as extremely large wildfires in the West, the Rocky Mountain pine beetle epidemic that is prevalent throughout the Rocky Mountains. Those catastrophic events have got to be managed in some way, and the only thing available to us, as I see it, is proper management and maximizing diversity of the various forest communities.
So what are we doing wrong with management today?
Well, I think that academically, we have developed the science and the knowledge of science almost beyond what 50 years ago would have been considered science fiction. But what's lacking is this understanding and ability to observe and see this complexity of nature, the complexity of the makeup of the forests, and then tie that to the science of forestry, the technology.
Now, you write that one of the main goals of the Forest Service seems to be extracting natural resources, whether that's logging or other kinds of resource extraction, rather than focusing on promoting healthy forests. Can you give us an example of something that you experienced or witnessed during your time in the Forest Service that kind of illustrates that?
Certainly. First of all, the concept of forest management since the 1890s and defined by Gifford Pinchot is called conservation, and it stands and means wise utilization, and the concept being that if we don't harvest more than we're growing, we can maintain a sustained yield for generations to come. But the focus has been on managing the resources from the forest. I read through almost every catalog of every major academic institution in the United States that teaches a curriculum in forest land management, and they define their program as training students to manage the natural resources from the forest. I can remember as a young forester within the Department of Agriculture that my job standard was basically telling, you know, describing what I needed to do in terms of meeting the outputs, the number of board feet of timber to be harvested, the number of grazing units to be produced. In other words, the expectations that leadership had of me as an employee was the production of goods and services, not the quality of management that was needed to maintain these healthy, vigorous forests.
What about later on when you were, say, managing the Bridger-Teton National Forest? Didn't you have more latitude to manage things as you saw fit at that point?
Well, I still work for the organization. We still had our own cultural values even within our organization. It was a very proud organization at the time. And I had a very rewarding career, but I was haunted by the fact that something was missing, and it was this detailed understanding of nature that was missing. And yes, I had some latitude and tried to influence the way things were being managed, but it's very difficult to write job standards and convey to employees the importance of the quality of management. It's much easier to measure things that are easily defined, such as, did you meet your assigned targets? Did you live within your budget? Did you produce the reports in a timely manner? And that tended still, even throughout my career, to be the way we evaluated performance on most of the employees, including myself as a force supervisor.
Now, you say that sort of our tendency to look at one aspect at a time of forests rather than looking at the ecosystem as a whole, you attribute that to kind of a cultural issue. Can you talk about what you mean there?
Well, I am convinced that the cultural values that the Western society has are actually creating an invisible barrier that is preventing the implementation of sound science. The concept of domination, conquest, and in particular greed, which I interpret as this quest for wealth and affluency, has stood in the way of applying some of the proper scientific data and information that exists. And my concern is that rather than focusing on what we can take from the forest, we need to be focused on managing the forest for health, vigor, and maximizing diversity. And that maximizing diversity is the main tool that's available to us to be able to reduce the risk of these catastrophic events that we're seeing.
So what changes would you like to see? What do you think needs to happen?
First of all, I think the most important thing that has to happen is that we have got to realize and understand that there is a difference between cultures and societies. And this continent had the experience of two cultures coming together that see nature very, very differently. We're losing this sensitivity to be able to read the land, to see this complexity of creation, complexity of nature, complexity of the forests. Our Native American ancestors had that ability, and somehow we've got to encourage a resurrection of those values and wisdom and link it to the science of forestry. What I hope will happen is that we will adopt the concepts of ecology, and we will see then the products from the forest as byproducts of good management, not as the goal of management.
Brian Stout is author of Trees of Life, Our Forests in Peril. Brian, thanks so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much.
That's our program for this week. If you want to hear it again or comment on the program, you can find it online at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Just look for Open Spaces.
You can also send us ideas for future programs on that site and sign up for our podcast. Anna Rader is our web editor. For those of you on Facebook, we invite you to become a fan of Wyoming Public Radio News by clicking on the like button. And you can follow all of us on Twitter.
Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.